We welcome a eminent professor at UL Lafayette, Dr. Richard Frankel, the UL History Department, to talk about something that has come up a lot lately, the big lie in American politics and elsewhere. That is, when you tell a lie that's so big and so crazy that no one could possibly believe it, could they? Well, apparently they could, and that's why we're talking about it. Dr. Frankel was born in New York on Long Island. He went to college at SUNY Buffalo. He got his PhD in history at the UNC Chapel Hill, University of North Carolina. He's been at UL about 16 years. He's currently an associate professor in the history department, and he teaches German, the Holocaust, and nationalism. Welcome to the show again, Dr. Frankel.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Good. Well, my research is into the Civil War era and Reconstruction and all those kind of things. Kind of led me to the idea of the big lie, which in Southern terms is known as the Lost Cause. The idea that the Civil War wasn't really about slavery. It was just a disagreement about arcane political matters between members of the same family, and it was resolved and everyone was glorious. And, of course, completely writes African-Americans out of the whole picture. So that's the kind of the big lie that papered over the split and what really happened in the Civil War. But today we're here to talk about a little different kind of big lie. This is the big lie, the current big lie that says that Trump won the election by a landslide, millions of votes in his own words, or the election was stolen, it was rigged, and this despite no evidence of fraud, deceit, bad behavior, or irregularities of any significant size. So people, not me, I'm not original with this, but it certainly occurred to me, have been thinking that this stolen election story will become an article of faith for those who identify closely with Trump and the Republican Party, and we see movement in that direction right now. So tell us, relying on your vast store of information with regard to Germany, and how does the big lie work in popular consciousness?
Yeah, it works. It functions in a number of ways. On the one hand, it serves to unify people. It creates a sense of community to believe in the lies. Again, this is obviously not Trump's first lie. This has been what he's been doing since he got into politics with the birther conspiracy. And it, in a sense, provides membership. Belief in the lies is kind of a requirement to be a member of the community. And those who don't believe, who question his statements, are obviously outsiders. And it sets Trump up, in a sense, as the only source of truth. You have to believe him as the leader. It also, in the case of, for example, the big lie of the stolen election, provides followers a sense of persecution. Right, they're a group that's bound together by the sense that everyone is out to get them. There's this powerful force out to persecute them for their beliefs, and that then fits into a kind of conspiratorial worldview that they obviously again already share. That there are these powerful hidden forces out there, whether it's the deep state, whether it's George Soros or what have you. That are able to do just about anything. And so something like the big lie, which again, to outsiders sounds absurd, to them makes sense, right? It's completely believable. And it also provides scapegoats, right? Those who are responsible, for whatever mishap in this case, or the conspiracy in this case, the stolen election, it provides them targets. Right, to direct their anger and their hostility towards. So it serves a number of functions, all within this sort of political culture of the right, and now the Trump right.
Well, there's a lot in there. First thing, you noted that the big lie, the stolen election, isn't really the first Trump lie. In fact, people have been following Donald Trump for a while, and it quickly became evident that he could not tell the truth. Mm-hmm. So thousands and lies poured out of his mouth, some, you know, on a daily basis, some as many as 40 or 50 a day. So I'm just wondering, what's the relationship of all those little lies to then the bigger and bigger lie? Does it create the groundwork for that?
Yeah, I think it serves to, it's odd on the one hand, because of course some of those lies are just silly and meaningless. But I think, taken together, it serves to create a kind of alternate reality, right? That, again, they inhabit. Even the small ones, they just fit into this larger approach of his. And again, it's something that he's been doing all along. And again, it's kind of a marker, right? It makes it also very difficult to argue against. How can you argue against someone who's so fast and loose with the truth, right? You can't confront them with facts. And in fact, if anything, providing them with facts only hardens their resistance, right? And their loyalty then to Trump.
Yeah,
so
it all
fits.
Yeah, it seems like in terms of building your community, you would build it, which you talked about in membership in that community, which I find a very interesting from a sociological point of view, a very interesting part of this is that you start to build a community of faith almost. Faith, for example, that Obama was a Muslim, that he wasn't born in this country. You know, he's not really a citizen. Then that continues. And there are a number of others. I'm skipping them. But, certainly in the inauguration, it was the biggest inauguration ever. The crowd, people. So at each point, you're kind of given an opportunity to believe or not believe. But belief allows you entry. Correct me if I'm wrong with the way the psychology works here. Belief and stated belief allows you entry into this membership community of people of true believers.
Right.
And reinforces. Right. So is that right?
Yeah. It's in some respects, it's sort of a public acknowledgement of it. It doesn't necessarily mean that everybody, in the community believes every single lie that he says, but you simply acknowledge, in general that what he says is the truth. And that's the requirement, again, is simply to accept what he says. And I think, again, the big ones they accept, particularly because of their already existing, sort of conspiratorial worldview. It's very much like this, paranoid style of politics that he plays masterfully. These are people who are already drawn to that even before he came along. And he, of course, reinforces it. He provides, a kind of stamp of approval, even if he claims, I don't know QAnon, but he, of course, never denounces these kinds of things. And so all of that, whether it's just a wink like that or his own contribution, fits in. And that kind of that kind of worldview, in a sense, requires it, because by definition, it's false. Right? I mean, the conspiracy in and of itself is not true, but it requires, all of these lies in order to believe it. Right? Again, to be on the inside. From the outside, it looks absurd, but from the inside, it all makes sense. That's the nature of a conspiratorial worldview. Right? There are no accidents. Everything is logical from a certain basic assumption, and everything can be explained because the conspirators are, of course, all powerful. And so evidence that contradicts it, of course, can be explained away because it's provided by the conspirators. Right? So it's very difficult, again, as I said, it's not impossible to disprove to those who are on the inside.
This taps a deep vein in American history, and I know that you're a German historian, but people have commented on the paranoid style in American politics. Richard Hofstadter, of course, a historian in the 40s and 50s, very influential, talking about, conspiracies and paranoia run deep in the American character and constantly, are bubbling all the time. That being the case, do you think Trump particularly kind of has tapped this vein and that's always been there, or is there something else going on?
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, he certainly didn't start this, and his career is interestingly enough, built on lies himself. I mean, he described his style as, I think it was called, enhanced reality, where in terms of selling his products, he would add 10 floors to the building that he was building that didn't exist, and he would just constantly lie about his own businesses and so forth and his business affairs. And so, when it came to entering the world of politics for him, it was no doubt a seamless transition. And in terms of the kinds of people he was looking to appeal to, they were prepared for that. Again, that style of politics, sure, it's been a part of American history. It takes a number of different forms. The conspiracies have changed over time, and the bad guys have changed over time. But there has been, this style of politics. It's not always, in the mainstream. It's usually on the fringes and only comes in at various points in history. And he's coming at a time when it was perhaps more closer to the mainstream after 9/11, perhaps, and conspiracies regarding that and so forth.
These big shocks to
him. And then
the
birther conspiracy, which he sort of jumped on, right?
Yeah,
so
I think
it was a good fit for him.
Yeah, you're right. Somebody referred to, and I heard it, I can't claim credit for this, as a P.T. Barnum. Trump is P.T. Barnum for the political set, It's the oddities he captures, and he captures the imagination, and he spins the what ifs, and there's somebody behind this, and who knew, and, this kind of the grotesqueries of American politics searched into no corner too insignificant to find something.
And as it was already making its way into the party, so it wasn't, he didn't even have to do that part of it. It was already, again, with the birther ideas and so forth, that the parts of the GOP were already kind of embracing some of that, and he sped the process along, I would say.
And I think that was the big surprise to political scientists like myself, like me, was that, we knew that paranoid streak was there, and we knew that conspiratorial thinking and this kind of us against them thinking was around, but we didn't realize how potent and how popular it would be. For example, when Trump made his claims in the Republican Party, I think most people thought, he's a fringe guy. Sure, there'll be some people out on the edge and the fringe that will support him. But most people, the Republican Party, we know, the low taxes, small government people, will just like, no, he's not acceptable. But then we were obviously surprised.
Right. Sure.
Listen, so let's move on and talk about some comparisons. So this is something that Hitler wrote in Mein Kampf. All this was inspired by the principle, he said, which is quite true, that in the big lie, there is always a certain force of credibility, because the broad masses of a nation are always more easily corrupted in the deeper strata of their emotional nature than consciously or voluntarily. And thus, in the primitive simplicity of their minds, they more readily fall victims to the big lie than the small lie, since they often tell themselves small lies and little matters and would be ashamed to resort to large-scale falsehoods. It would never come into their minds to fabricate colossal untruths, and they would not believe that others could have the impudence to distort the truth so infamously. So the small lie doesn't work as well as the big lie for some people, that because there's a certain – it strains credulity, you then say, geez, it must be true because, this is crazy. So it obviously is true, right?
Right, right, right.
So let's talk about the relation of the big lie that we're discussing today. And by the way, we are talking, in case you just tuned in, to Dr. Rich Frankel of the UL History Department, who is an expert on Germany, the Holocaust, and – a number of other things, nationalism. What's the relationship of this big lie to, say, the German period, the big lie in the German that inspired Hitler?
Yeah, I think...
tell us about that one. How did that one work?
Sure. What became known as the stab in the back legend, or the stab in the back myth in Germany, involved not a stolen election, but a stolen victory. Toward the end of the war in 1918, the story was that the German army was just on the verge of victory. It was right within its grasp. But certain forces on the home front, certain un-German elements, Jews, Marxists, and others, had been working to undermine morale on the home front, spreading defeatist sentiment and so forth, encouraging strikes, which ultimately succeeded in leading to revolution, which collapsed the home front, which meant the army could no longer fight and therefore had to sue for peace just before it was about to win. The reality is just like with the stolen election, it's the precise opposite, that the army recognized that it was going to lose. It told the civilian government to sue for peace, and when word got out of that, then the revolution broke out. And so it's a complete reversion or flip-flopping of history, but it became sort of an article of faith, particularly on the right, for those who simply couldn't accept the notion of Germany losing the war. And that became a very powerful myth. It was backed early on, before Hitler ever got hold of it. It was promoted, not surprisingly, by the leaders of the military, Paul von Hindenburg in particular, and Erich Ludendorff, who were the leaders of the army at the time. And they publicly spread this myth that the army was about to win, but instead had been stabbed in the back. And of course, that gives a tremendous weight, right? A tremendous credence to those who want to believe.
I'm curious about and of course, another quote from Mein Kampf says, by placing responsibility for the loss of the World War on the shoulders of Ludendorff, they took away the weapon of moral right. And they were mm-hmm. unlikely to succeed in bringing the betrayers of the fatherland to justice. So, you know, they put they blamed Ludendorff, the big lie blamed, you know, or the people blamed Ludendorff for the victory when in fact he'd been stabbed in the back and would have won. Mm-hmm. I'm curious about these certain un-German elements. And of course, I'm thinking about for the Jews, the communists. Were certainly those elements that were referred to or were picked on, cosmopolitan. Does that have a analogy to certain un-American elements that have been picked on by Donald Trump?
Yeah, again, this is where one of those parallels, I think, comes in and has really dangerous implications. I mean, you know, in the German case, looking at Jews in particular, and, you know, and for Nazis, for example, Jews and Marxists were one and the same. You referred to them as Judeo-Bolsheviks. So the idea that these were traitors in their midst, these un-German elements, for Hitler, if he was going to, as he promised, you know, make Germany great again, those elements had to be removed, right? They had already demonstrated what they can do in the First World War. If they were going to have another war, which Hitler intended, obviously they couldn't be there again. And so it provided a further justification for, you know, again, the creation of a German national community through the removal of those elements that were outside, you know, outsiders and dangerous. And in the case of the stolen election, I think it's fairly clear from the ways in which Trump and his legal team went about fighting it. It was African Americans who were the real targets here. It was predominantly African-American districts where they challenged the vote totals and so forth, and where they challenged the legitimacy of the count. And eliminating those votes, as they would have wanted to do, you know, in order to gain victory. And so there clearly was, you know, a racial element to this particular conspiracy, right? They might not have been behind it. You know, maybe it was Soros, maybe it was the deep state, but they were the visible component of it, right? And if you eliminate African Americans from voting, which of course, again, is you know, something that the GOP has been trying to do now for decades, you know, that makes it clear. Again, it fits into that larger pattern, right? And so whether it's Jews behind the stab in the back, or it's African Americans with the stolen election and illegally voting or whatever explanation he had, the implication, again, is clear that they're dangerous, right? They have to be removed somehow from the national community, obviously, maybe not physically, but certainly politically, right, in terms of their political rights, right, have to be scaled back.
Yeah, it seems like, and it's pretty clear that Trump's been working on this for his whole career, but particularly his political career in the last 4-6 years, you know, certainly calling certain people who are clearly American, un-American. Remember saying, I want them to go back to their blank hole countries.
Right.
You know, and those were congresswomen. So, you know,
exactly.
Wow. You know, so it doesn't matter that you've been elected to Congress. You can still clearly be un-American and not belong here. Building the wall, focus on the wall, and Mexicans, they're coming over. They're rapists, they're animals, and I assume some good people would be an example. And then, you know, going after the cosmopolitans. They know better, the elitists, right? They don't believe in God. They're secularists. They're
globalists,
urban.
Right?
Yeah, they're what?
Globalists.
Globalists, yeah, they're globalists. So they're not, you know, there's a real sense here in Donald Trump, and you wonder if is Donald Trump pushing towards a racial kind of view of who is American and who is not. You know, certainly that was a big part of German exclusion, right? Or some parallels there?
Yeah, in fact, that was really at, you know, at the heart of my book about this idea of exclusion, right? I mean, this was really, I think, at the heart of his politics was, and in that sense, very similar to German nationalists and to Hitler, in that you create community, right? You envision this real German community or this real American community, you know, you define it, who belongs, and those who don't belong have to be removed, right? And so for Trump, it's this white Christian, you know, paternalistic America, and therefore all of those who don't fit, whether they're you know, Latin Americans, whether they're African Americans, whether they're Jews, and you know, variously defined. I'm sure there's you can find some discussion in there. But the idea is that, you know, when you have that community, when they're all together as just Americans, and they're not, they don't have these divisive elements in their midst, right? These potential traitors in their midst. Then America can be great, right? That's exactly the argument that Hitler made about making Germany great, right? The German community together, right? When it's just Germans, no class divisions, no regional divisions, you know, and so forth. Once you remove those and you put them, you push them outside of the boundaries of the community, then, you know, then you can do great things, right? Then America can return to its greatness, whenever that, you know, whenever that was. And so certainly, you know, and for Hitler, it is very much based on, I would say, based on race, as you pointed out, you know, for his whole life. You know, it's been no secret of his racism.
It's really incredible. You know, as you're talking, I'm thinking, and some parallels are existing here. So for a long time, the South, white Southerners always said that it was blacks that held the region back. You know, there was a real strong racial component there. If you know, if we just had white people in the South, then, you know, of course, the South would be much better. Like you may say the South is poor and slovenly and uneducated and this and that. But it's black people. That's what you're really talking about. So and so the same thing with the Germans, who then, as I'm paraphrasing you, basically, if we could get rid of the non-Germans, the non-Aryans, because they're not part of us, Germany would be great. You know, the South would be great without blacks. Germany would be great without Jews, communists, and other kinds of the mud races, so to speak. And then America, moving on to Trump's vision, you start to think, huh, well, it looks like the thing that's keeping, in Trump's vision, the thing that's keeping America from being great again has to do with these Mexicans, these blacks, these cosmopolitans, these secularists, these globalists. So, I mean, it seems pretty parallel, or am I just reading too much into this?
No, I think, you know, and again, you don't even necessarily, I mean, obviously the German example is I think, very important and very valuable. But as you pointed out, I mean, that goes back, you know, you can go back to the 20s and 30s, if not, you know, earlier. My you know, comparative work takes the United States in from the late 19th into the early 20th century. And the kind of politics from those periods was very similar, right? You know, maybe some different targets, right? In the 20s and 30s, it's Catholics and Jews and African-Americans. And, you know, maybe today the Catholics have dropped out. But this notion of, you know, creating a unified community, a pure community of, you know, quote unquote, real American. I mean, that's at the heart of nationalism. You know, it's not unusual in that sense if you're a nationalist. That goes along with it, right? That there is a national community. And of course, it has to be defined in some way. And the history of this country, just as the history of Germany and other countries as well, when you once you involve nationalism, is a struggle over the defining the nation, right? Who belongs and who doesn't. And that can be based on race, it can be based on religion, it can be based on a number of different things. And those who get into power, who win the struggle, at least temporarily, get to make the rules, right? And so in the case of Germany, the Third Reich was one phase of that struggle in which, for those 12 years, you know, the Nazi view won out, right? And they could make the rules, and they could define who is a citizen and who is not a citizen, which is exactly what they did during those 12 years. And then afterward, you know, it was another set of definitions, you know, that came into play. And obviously, in the case of Germany, the racial one is going to be, unacceptable. But in the United States, we never really had that reckoning. And so I think it's stayed as a force, a potential force for power in America the way it hasn't in Germany.
One of the things that occurred to me while you were talking, I was thinking, you know, America's always been struggling with this, and we have created our own kind of racial superior sense here in the United States, but it's happened so gradually over so long. Like, it's pretty easy to look back to Hitler and go, oh, you know, creating the Aryan state. But I'm thinking about, you know, how, you know, right now in America, you are called white if you are one of any kind of remotely European groups. But initially, initially America was, an English community. And then Germans came in, and then gradually over a course of a generation or two, they got incorporated. Then the Scots-Irish, then the Irish. That was a big struggle, you know. There's a book called How the Irish Became White. And then the Jews came in, and the Italians came in. That was really tough because they were kind of dark. But gradually, all of those were incorporated into this kind of artificial white status, which somehow solved the question in America is, how do you have a racial republic in a multi-ethnic, multi-racial place, of course? So,
right. And I mean, the immigration laws of the early 20s is in part what helped that along, right? Once you shut, you know, turn off the spigot from Southern and Eastern Europe, which they did in 1924, and you have about four decades of almost no immigration from Asia and from those areas that Americans had problems with, Jews, as you point out, Italians and Eastern Europeans, they have time to assimilate. And there is this sense that it's not as much of a problem. But again, I mean, the Second World War played a role in beginning the process of overcoming anti-Semitism, immediately, but you know, fighting the Nazis and so forth and seeing what the Nazis did.
Well, it's pretty hard to maintain a racial republic in the United States when we're fighting a racial republic elsewhere, as many people have talked.
They managed it, though.
You know, they did.
You know, about it 20 years later after the end of the war is when you get the Civil Rights Act, Civil Rights Act passed and so forth. So it was always a slow process. And it comes in waves, these kinds of racist moments in American history. As I said, late 19th century, the 1890s, and then the interwar period, the 1950s and 60s, and now.
Yeah, and now.
So it's not always there. It's part of
happening right in front of us.
Right.
Dr. Frankel, we have enjoyed having you today, and you certainly enlightened us. We've come to the end of our program. We've been talking to Dr. Rich Frankel from the UL History Department about the big lie in today's politics. Check out his book, States of Exclusion. Thanks so much for being on the show.
Thank you very much, Pearson. I really appreciate it.
Bayou to Beltway is copyrighted by KRVS for the private use of its audience. Any other use of any portion of this program without written consent of KRVS is prohibited. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the views of KRVS, its officers, or members. To listen to a podcast of the interview we just heard, Go to krvs.org. This is KRVS 88.7 FM, Lafayette, Lake Charles.